When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books and Music, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am Emily Allen, your host for this episode. For our conversation today, I am speaking with Dr. Horace Maxiel and Dr. Kristen Turner, who you might also know from the NBN, about their book, Race and Gender in the Western Music History Survey, published by Routledge in 2022. So a little bit more about the book. Race and Gender in the Western Music History Survey, a Teacher's Guide, provides concrete information and approaches that will help instructors include women and people of color in the typical music history survey course and the foundational music theory classes. This book provides a reconceptualization of the principles that shape the decisions instructors should make when crafting the syllabus. It offers new perspectives on canonical composers and pieces that take into account musical, cultural, and social context where women and people of color are present. Secondly, it suggests new topics of study and pieces by composers whose work fits into a more inclusive narrative of music history. A thematic approach parallels the traditional chronological sequencing in Western music history classes. Three themes include people and communities that suffer from various kinds of exclusion, locales and locations, forms and factions, responses and reception. Each theme is designed to uncover a different cultural facet that is often minimized in traditional music history classrooms, but which, if explored, lead to topics in which other perspectives and people can be included organically in the curriculum while not excluding canonical composers. So that's the book. A little bit about our guest. Dr. Horace Maxiel is Associate Professor of Music Theory at Baylor University. His primary interests are the concert music of Black composers, music semiotics, and gospel music. His research has appeared in journals such as Perspectives of New Music, American Music, the Journal of the Society for American Music, and Black Music Research Journal. And our second guest is Dr. Kristen Turner, who is a lecturer in the music and honors departments at North Carolina State University. Her work centers on issues of race, gender, and class in American popular culture at the turn of the 20th century. Her research has appeared in collected editions in scholarly journals, including the Journal of the American Musicological Society, the Journal of the Society for American Music, American Studies, and Musical Quarterly. So thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Awesome. All right. So let's get started with a little bit of background here. So Kristen, I'll start with you on this question. Can you tell us how you came to work on this book?
Sure. I guess around 2015, maybe a little later, Kira Thurman, who teaches history, she's an associate professor now at University of Michigan, reached out to me and asked me if I would co-author something with her on diversity in the music history classroom that we wrote for Musicology Now, which is the American Musicological Society's blog. And it was very commonsensical. It just said, here are six ways that you can immediately diversify your classroom. And that got a lot of traction. We got a lot of great feedback from that. And at one point, Jim Davis, who is the editor of a series at Routledge on pedagogy, contacted me and asked us to write a book that sort of expanded upon what we had done, what Kira and I had done in that blog post. And Kira was not able at that point to write this book with me. She's primarily a historian, and so she needed to concentrate on some other things at that point. So I went to Tammy Kernodle, who is a good friend of mine and a musicologist as well, and said, help, I can't write this book by myself. I don't, you know, when you're talking about something that is going across all periods, and we wanted to think about as many different aspects of the Western music history survey type courses as possible. There was no way I could do that by myself. And she suggested Horace might be a great person to work with. I already knew Horace just a little bit, and she turned out to be absolutely right. And I should let Horace tell you how he got involved.
Yes, it was basically Tammy was the gel that kind of put us together. And I think it was at a SAM meeting, the one in New Orleans. I can't put the date, maybe 2018, 2019, somewhere around there, where we, you know, had lunch and discussed it. I think it was at a Vietnamese restaurant in New Orleans, go figure. And so we, you know, we talked about the project and the idea. I was like, I think I'm okay, but you do know I'm a theorist, right? And of course, Kristen said, yeah, of course I know. And so from there, we just kind of talked about it. But I also found the project intriguing because I struggled in music history as an undergraduate. And I just wish that there was a little bit more that could have been done to make it a little more interesting to me. So the idea of the sequence as it was given to me as an undergrad, I was like, if there's anything that I could even try to do to try to add a little more spice or flavor to that, let's try it and see what comes out of it. And the conversation happened, and then of course COVID hit, but the seed was already there, and we just watered it over the COVID pause.
I'll add that by the time we started working on this book, I'd been teaching for almost 25 years, and almost every year I would teach the Western Music History Survey. And I had gone from teaching it exactly the way that it was taught to me, which was the most traditional way possible. I think the only women we covered was Hildegard of Bingen and maybe, you know, Clara Schumann. No people of color whatsoever. And by the time Horace and I started working on the book, I was teaching it very differently, but wanted to teach it even more differently. And one of the things that I found was that I just didn't know enough. Like I did not have the time to sit down and research just gobs of material to come up with new things I could say to my classroom. Unless, of course, you're writing a book and then you don't have a choice. And then you've said you would do that. So I felt like the teacher that I wanted to help with, that I wanted to be able to teach that class better than I had taught it. And I needed this information that we try to present in this book to help me do that.
Yeah, I think that you both brought some very complementary perspectives to this theorist, musicologist, what you wanted as a student and what you wanted on the other end as a teacher. So I think that's really awesome that you all were able to collaborate in that way and really make this a great resource. So as you kind of came together with your different types of expertise, what was the process of working on this book like through that journey? So if Kristen, you maybe want to kick us off.
Well, as Horace said, we met at a Vietnamese restaurant. I think it was the 2019 SAM because COVID hit not too, you know, like basically a year later. And he was the one who really came up with the themes, and we had sort of figured out together how we wanted each chapter to look, and we never really looked back. I'm not sure that it ever really changed from the time that we started. So that each period starts with an introduction that tries to recenter the typical introduction away from just always centering the canonic composers, but thinking about other issues. And then there's two lesson plans, a theory and a sort of more historical one, and then a bunch of bibliographies. And we decided we were going to do that right from the start. And it was such an easy process. Like, we just had this conversation. We figured it out in like 30 minutes over pho, you know, so it was not bad. It was such a joy and so easy because we we realized, at least on my side, we realized that we really had a lot of the same ideas. And, it, you know, we weren't ever arguing about what we were going to do. So, Horace, what else would you say?
I would say with regard to process, really thinking about a thematic way of teaching music history, because I was also thinking about conversations that I've been hearing about different ways to teach music history, where some programs might just do a not necessarily a period course, but a highly specialized course for a year, and students could pick and choose which ones they wanted to take to create their own thing there with regard to the music history sequence or what have you. And then, of course, there's also this traditional view and this chronological view, which has a lot of which makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. And so I was really thinking about ways to, how can I thematically tie some of these things together? What would have made more sense to me as an undergraduate? And that was, for me, it was just that thing, because for me, music history was just, it was rough. Me and dates don't get along that well. And so it's just like, okay, this happened. And so instead of this very, sterile, okay, these are the things that happened in this period, and you need to know this composer, this composer, this composer, and then let's move to the next page and do the same thing. And I was like, well, where's the music in that? I'm getting the history, but I'm not getting the music. And so I think the themes, or thematic approach, at least, set up a sort of lyricism for me to try to tie some things together. And of course, Kristen was on board with that idea. I didn't think it would fly, you know, talking to your traditional music history teacher who's been doing it for so long. But the whole idea of this lyrical approach to things that were otherwise sterile, at least for me, fell on good ground.
I'll say, in terms of just writing, we were never in the same room. We didn't see each other again until, what, Horace, over a year after the book had been published?
Yes.
And of course, part of that was it was during COVID, but it was completely online. We would call each other every couple of months and have the, like, 4 or 5 months, and we'd say, okay, now what are you going to write? And we would decide what we were going to do next, apportion out the sort of the who was going to do what, and say we were going to have it done by this date, and it would get done. And, you know, I mean, it was a pretty easy process. Right. We read each other's stuff, and right. So that there was a second reader, and I have a writing group I've been with for a long time, and they read some of it as well. So, and Horace brought it to some people so that we could have a, you know, more pairs of eyes on it. But it was a very, I would be happy to write more books with Horace, because it was a very easy process.
And I would say, once we got a handle on what the first chapter looked like, I think the first one was the classical one.
It was.
We'll put scare quotes around that. Oh, you can't see the scare quotes, but I just did that. So once we figured out the form of that and what it would look like and what we wanted to have in it, I would say that there was a non-negotiable for me, and it was that we had to have scores inside the book. That was the only thing that I said, well, we have to do that, because if there's, you know, if there are accompanying anthologies that go along with all the traditional texts, then at least those musical, those full scores could serve as a mini anthology, at least for the topics that were being presented.
I love that. This is so inspiring to hear as a junior scholar that collaboration is great. So I will definitely aspire to get on y'all's level with the co-authoring process. And I think that I appreciate you all clarifying kind of the organization a little bit. You know, I love the way, Horace, you put it in terms of its lyrical structure and bringing your theorist hat to the table by emphasizing scores. So I think, and then, you know, Kristen's expertise as a pedagogue and having that musicology side. So I think that that's really shows throughout the book. And listeners, just to kind of recap, the themes that they were talking about are the three following: locales and locations, forms and factions, responses and reception. So they use that across the different chapters, but it's still kind of user-friendly for the chronological approach as well. So they kind of played out both chronological and thematic across the book. So it's very user-friendly, which I really appreciated. So I'm looking forward to using this resource the next time I teach this class, which actually leads me maybe to my next question. And I think you all were kind of getting at this a little bit, but, you know, How do you envision instructors using this book in there? You were kind of talking about how you could maybe use it with other anthologies, but how do you envision instructors using this book? Are there any pedagogical approaches that you have tried that made their way into this book? Maybe we can start with Kristen on this one.
What I have always imagined is that anyone who's teaching Western classical music, not just the traditional freshman survey, but just sort of any course that's mostly classical music, I hope what they do is, literally look at the bibliographies and see the incredible wealth of information that's out there. I was very surprised, actually, how much research has been done on women and people of color, even in early music, for instance, which we both thought was going to be difficult, but it turned out there was plenty there, at least for teaching purposes, right? I mean, there's something really different between articles and things that are helpful for teachers and students and stuff that's really more scholarly based. Like, what teachers need is stuff that gives you basic information and allows, I think, and allows the teacher to incorporate it into what they're already doing, right? So if you look at the bibliography, you're like, wow, I would love to teach about choral music in Mexico. Here is an article about choral music in Mexico. And there's only one, right? We don't have room for five. You can, the teacher can read about it and go to other sources from that, from that article if they want to. But know that we've picked an article that we think would be good for teaching, and that is that hopefully will be enough information to teach a class on without much else, right? Because most people who come to this know enough to be able to say, oh, now that I know about this, I'll slot it in here. We also have a bibliography of pieces with a score that's pretty easily available and a recording because it's nice to have both, right? But actually, that takes an enormous amount of time. That took more time than anything else we did was those bibliographies. Gore, you can't see it, but Horace is shaking his head. It took forever because there's actually, it's one or the other. It's very rarely both. So I think for me, I hope that people will do that. We'll start with the bibliographies. The second thing is if they look at our lesson plans, I mean, of course, it's great if they want to just use them. I've had people tell me that that's what they've done. They want to just get through something quickly and they're just using all of those. And that's 10 lessons right there that's out there. But I think we're both hoping that it would also serve as a repository of ideas. Oh, I really don't want to teach this piece, but oh, but I could do it like this. Like, I could do the research to take this approach, or I could use the stuff that's in a theory lecture for this other piece that I have access to, or whatever, so that hopefully it will spur some creativity as well on the part of teachers. One reason that I liked the themes is that it allows teachers to, I hope, to think about multiple ways to approach the same material. So I don't know if you're looking at if you look at like a le one of the lesson plans, at the end, we go through and discuss each theme with basic, it's basically the same information and it's about the same pieces, but it's like, well, yes, you could approach it this way or this way or this way, right? So that the idea is that every piece of material that one uses in a class can be an opening into so many different ways to think about music. It doesn't have to be just what we said. It could be a lot of other things. The lesson plans also have these further considerations, which are the same sort of thing. Sometimes these are things I've tried, other times they're not. Of course, I'll have to speak to the theory lessons that he taught, but the idea really was, well, maybe you could do this in another lesson, you maybe on a totally different topic, but here's an idea. Maybe you want to talk about music scenes, but not in relationship to Florence Price and Aaron Copland, which is where we talked about in the book. Maybe you want to do it for 18th century Paris, or I don't know, 12th century Florence or something, whatever it might be, or 20th, first century, wherever you live. But the idea is here's something that you might be able to do.
Yeah, that hit basically everything. The other piece that I thought about at the book's inception was actually the graduate theory review. And I thought, what a fun way to learn or relearn or refamiliarize yourself with the large body of information that folks expect you to keep and spit out and so on and so on. And so I actually thought about perhaps what if graduate surveys were taught thematically? What if the graduate survey was locales and location? And then you just run through that chronologically, but really focusing on locales and locations, using the book or using locales and locations for other canonical works, or using forms and factions as a theme for an entire semester, or you know, responses and receptions for an entire semester. And so the book also can function in that way to give you starting places to you know, and lessons and from a canonical and non-canonical composer, but also maybe thinking about other composers that could be approached that way in the given time periods. So that way you can kind of have some chronological basis, but not even have students not even think about it as a chronological course, but really thinking about it thematically, and using those themes as a way to tie together a full-blown, you know, semester, still hitting on all of the things that need to be learned and need to be retained, but through a totally different lens. And so that was, so on top of everything Kristen just outlined with regard to teachers and the resources there, but just the idea of presenting an entire semester without saying graduate music survey, you know, or graduate music history survey. Let's just call it locales and locations, and then we'll do all the work under that umbrella.
That's really cool. And I think I'm glad you brought up the graduate survey, you know, because I think about, for instance, like for schools that have like big ethnomusicology programs, there's like a lot of international students sometimes that come into these more traditional conservatory spaces. So I think that would be a really great way for people from really any kind of cultural context to find something to latch onto and maybe relate to more that way. So I see what you're saying. That would be really, I think, a really creative way to do that. And I appreciate you, Kristen, mentioning that you talked about how you've heard back from people about how they've been using this too. So that was going to be my other question was, you know, how have you heard people doing that? So I'm really glad that, you know, it sounds like you all, and from what I was seeing in the book, there's structure, but there's also a lot of flexibility with the book, which I think is a really great model and really great tool that people will hopefully utilize. And that leads me to what's probably going to be my last formal question, but is there anything else about this book that you feel like you want to touch on that we haven't already brought up? We can start with Horace on this one.
I would like to say that hopefully that music theory and music history aren't really seen as two different things. Yes, they're two different approaches, but we're still talking about music in different ways. I mean, the quote unquote theory lessons, if you want to call them those, you know, there's a little bit of stuff in there, but it's not jargon and it's not heavy on jargon and all that other stuff. I had to resist myself. I had to rewrite a couple of things because, yes, it would have been much easier to just say this prolongation of the dominant and da 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 da. But sometimes you don't want to get lost in jargon. And so maybe a more granular approach to certain moments in the score was what I was after there. And so to the degree that you want to lean into those moments and maybe direct, maybe have a more goal-directed listening before you enter a piece. And so that's why some of the portions of the lesson have nothing to do with theory questions at all, but actually cultural considerations that you might ask around the piece. What are some contextual things that are going around this moment? And maybe there are ways to make connections between what's happening orally and what might be happening socially with that composer at that particular time, particularly with the Burleigh and moving on into the 20th century. So, you know, to the degrees that the score, oral things, a little bit of analytical jargon can inform our reading of quote unquote history or historiography or however we want to frame that. All the better. I think it's all things working in the same direction, and we don't have to be so siloed in order to get students to get what we want them to get.
Yeah, it's a really great point. I think that makes the collaborative approach y'all took with this even more fruitful, thinking about it that way. So, yeah, thank you, Horace, for that. Kristen, do you have anything you want to add as well?
Well, I have to say that I think the book is so much better because Horace is a theorist. I am not a theorist at all. And so I learned a lot from the lessons that Horace wrote. And I think he has certainly inspired me to be better about talking about theory to my students. I don't work with music majors, so who don't have, and most of my students will never take music theory. So, there's some limitations into what I can do in my own classroom practice, but I hope that having lessons that really get into the notes is helpful to people. And for those lessons, those are all pieces that are not in any anthology that we were aware of. So the point is that here are pieces that are not even in, the women, there's like women's anthologies of music, like they're not in those either. The whole, and they're certainly not in the traditional anthologies that go with the textbooks. So the idea is like everything about this is supposed to be a new resource. So that introductions, for instance, we were very careful that we have sort of an overview and then we go through the three themes, and each theme has a different uses a different case study in the theme. The idea being that's three more places, three more types of music that or topics that someone might use. Because honestly, that paragraph is enough to start with, right? You only have to talk in a music history survey class, you only have to be able to talk about something well for about 30 minutes, right? And then there's listening to music and answering questions, right? And then so you really you don't, I think sometimes teachers think they have to have this incredibly deep knowledge. Like, I can't talk about this unless I know everything there is to know about that topic. And that's not true. Like, you really just need 30 minutes, right? And all, I think musicians are trained to be able to look at music and understand it. And if you have a little bit more topic, subject matter understanding, then you can teach about a lot of things. You can't teach about it for long, but you can teach about it long enough for a class or two, right? And that this book is really about like, okay, here's enough to teach about it for a class or two, right? The other thing was, I think that the book is designed to remind us that that musicologists, at least, we tend to think of the canon, many of us, as sort of a bad thing, right? Like, oh God, not more Beethoven, not more this, right? And maybe that's true as for young scholars who want to look at new things or whatever. Like, there's the scholarly part where we're trying to sort of interrogate the canon and maybe even tear it down and all of those things. But in the classroom, we really wanted to show that it's still important. The canon is still important. Like, you cannot teach the 19th century without Beethoven. Like, or the rest of 19th century music does not make sense because Beethoven was very powerful and important to every composer who lived during, in the 19th century. It does not matter what their background was, right? So we really wanted to encourage people not to think of this as being subtractive, but additive, right? And that, but that. The other thing that I hear teachers worry about is I don't want to be tokenistic, right? I don't want people to think, well, now I've done my person of color for the 14, for the 18th century and now I'm done, right? But no, that's another great thing about the themes, is that the whole point is if you think about music in a holistic way and you think about it as composers and pieces and performers and patrons and where they played and who they played for and what people said about it, you cannot leave out women and people of color. Like, you can't. You can leave out white women and people of color if all you care about is a very small amount of music made in a very small number of places by a very small number of people for a very particular audience. Then you can leave out anybody but white men. But if you think about it more holistically, you have to, there needs to be canonic pieces there because they were important and those people are important, but there also are all these other people and all this other amazing music and all these other places to talk about. And I was really struck by Horace saying that music history was hard for him, right? I think a lot of people find that. But if you can come in and say, look at this cool thing they were doing in the Philippines in the 1500s or, you know, whatever, or Mexico in the 1700s or whatever. I don't think that you have to share a cultural background with someone to say, wow, that is so much more interesting than not again, we're looking at Italy, like, you know, and I think it does. And it's exciting. I don't know, as a teacher, it's exciting to me to be able to share that because I get tired of teaching about Italy too.
Yeah, I think what I also was struck, and I don't think I highlighted this earlier, but it's both your perceptions as students too that you bring to the table. Like even still from what you were saying, like it sounds like you learned a lot even just working on this book. And then Horace's expertise as a student and, you know, looking back on that. So I think it's great that both ends of the spectrum here, both the teacher's perspective, but also the learner's perspective was brought into this text. So I appreciate you all bringing your expertise to this book and sharing this body of knowledge with us. And I hope that listeners, both students and teachers, will consult this and maybe think about how to, you know, revitalize the music history survey. So, but I just wanted to thank you both, Horace and Kristen, for talking with me today. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yes, thank you. It was great.
Yeah. And listeners, just to give you a quick recap, this was an interview for the New Books and Music channel with Dr. Horace Maxiel and Dr. Kristen Turner about their book, Race and Gender in the Western Music History Survey, which was published by Routledge in 2022. This is Emily Allen. I'll catch you next time here on the New Books Network.